to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show that features the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm your host for today, Greta Anderson, together with Gail Seiler. Hello, Gail.
Hello, Greta, and hello to our listeners. Thanks for joining us.
We've got a big show ahead of us, politics at the local, state, and national levels. But we can't let this moment pass without extending our condolences to Hawkeye fans.
Saturday night's Big Ten football championship game was an epic battle of two great defenses, but the Michigan State Spartans came out on top and will represent the Big Ten in the collegiate Final Four.
On the other hand, the Rose Bowl is not that bad of a consolation prize. Iowa Hawkeyes will be facing Stanford in Anaheim on January 1st.
Also, Greta, on a more serious note, did you see President Obama's address to the nation last night? This was one of only three times in his 7 years as president that he addressed the nation in this way.
I did. And I think we should be linking to a video of his talk on our own Local Talk homepage. You know, we're talking about participatory government. We're talking about people getting involved and being thoughtful and rational. So I think what he said and the tenor of his talk is something all Americans, including our listeners, should listen to and consider. So it will only take 5 to 10 minutes of your time to listen to our president address the issues of terrorism in the United States.
And we've got a packed show today. We've got a strict schedule to keep to on Local Talk. Later in the hour, we'll be speaking by phone with Carolyn Isaacs, the Arizona Program Director of the American Friends Service Committee, who will be in Iowa this week, including a stop in Ames on Wednesday, and she'll be talking about immigration, detention, and incarceration.
After that, we will be talking to some disabled Iowans and their allies who are joining forces to travel to Des Moines this morning and speak out against Governor Branstad's decision to privatize Medicaid. The Legislative Oversight Committee has devoted the entire day to discussing this issue and hearing from those affected, such as these folks.
But in the room with us right now, we have three people who've been deeply involved in an even more local issue than that, the shape of the Highway 30 corridor between Ames and Nevada. We have Ray Schwichtenberg from the Nevada City Council, Rick Sanders from the Story County Board of Supervisors, and Randy Collings, a resident of rural Nevada, who has been vocal regarding the DOT plan. Welcome to all three of you.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Good morning.
A bit of background on this issue. Currently, the stretch of Highway 30 between I-35 and Nevada's easternmost exit at 19th Street is composed only of at-grade crossings. There are a lot of these at-grade crossings at Sandhill Road, where the Crossroads Baptist Church and Cornerstone Churches have their turnoffs, then continuing west at 590th, or at 580th, 590th, 600th, 610th, and S14 and 6th Street, which is the main street in Nevada. So quite a few of those.
Compare that to Ames, where you have Dayton, Duff, University, and Dakota exits. All of these are two-level interchanges that involve a bridge. Vehicles going north-south pass over Highway 30.
So there are trade-offs to each of these kinds of highway intersections. With all the at-grade intersections, drivers have more choices about where to turn off or onto Highway 30 and more opportunities to cross it, albeit with more danger involved. With the interchanges, there are fewer options but more controlled traffic flow.
As many as 20 years ago, the S14 intersection at Highway 30 was identified as being dangerous. S14 is the road that runs alongside the county fairgrounds on the west side of Nevada. The place it intersects with Highway 30 is on one side of a rise that makes it very hard to see oncoming traffic from Ames, and the accident statistics back this up.
For the past 15 years or more, the City of Nevada and the Nevada Economic Development Corporation have gotten serious about wanting to address this situation at S14 and have repeatedly petitioned the Iowa Department of Transportation to engineer a solution. In 2012, the Iowa DOT committed to the project and since then has held several meetings with city officials and city council as the plan evolved. There were also public meetings. I have a timeline here where I can count at least three public meetings on the topic, as well as a written public comment period. According to Nevada Mayor Lynn Lathrop, who I spoke with, the plans have been a topic of discussion at 35 city council meetings since 2013, and all of those are open to the public as well. Although, Lynn added, very few people, if any, attend those meetings.
So ultimately, in March 2013, the council chose one of the two proposed DOT, Department of Transportation, plans. This one would build the interchange at Airport Road at 610th Street instead of S-14. It would close S-14 and 6th Street and would direct traffic to those major destinations through a road running parallel to Highway 30. Thus, the gateway of Nevada would be changing from 6th Street to Airport Road, a couple of miles to the west, where a lot of new development is occurring.
And that was in 2013. One or two Nevada residents were strongly opposed the plan from the beginning and spoke up against it. But people truly sat up and noticed when, this October, DOT presented Phase 2 of their plan, along with their presentation of Phase 1. And this would also close the intersections at 580th, 590th, and 600th. This is county, not city, territory. And they would build a new interchange, I believe, east of 580th. Suddenly, a whole host of folks, businessmen, and especially farmers, were up in arms. I attended a recent meeting where the Story County supervisors, including our guest Rick Sanders, heard from these folks, and one of those folks was another of my guests, Randy Collings.
At that November 3rd meeting, supervisors voted unanimously to write to the Iowa Department of Transportation expressing opposition to the three closures at 580th, 590th, and 600th. Among the most powerful arguments was the establishment of a large new farm equipment dealership, Vedder's, at 590th, one of the intersections to be closed by the plan, and a road that the county has recently upgraded due to increasing traffic. The other strong voice was that of farmers, who felt it was going to be far more dangerous for them to negotiate the new interchanges than it was to simply cross Highway 30 at grade during slow hours.
So, buoyed by their success with the supervisors, the opponents to the plan, both city and rural, showed up in force on November 17th to a special meeting of the Nevada City Council, devoted entirely to this subject. A petition with 1,000 signatures was presented to the councilmen, stating that the Airport Road plan would be fine if the council would only urge Iowa DOT to leave 6th Street open. But in the face of very high emotions of the meeting, the council voted to ask the DOT to start over, formulate a special task force. That would be the Nevada City Council would formulate a special task force to work with the Department of Transportation in developing another plan. This will certainly mean a delay and possibly some difficulty with funding, which has delayed the project as it's gone along. So, we've given a lot of history here. I'm going to ask Supervisor Sanders and Nevada Councilman Schwichtenberg, did I get my facts straight?
I think you did a great job. The only correction I would make is the proposed interchange at 580th would be west of 580th, not east.
It would be between
580th and Sand Hill Trail as it's proposed.
Okay, that's right. So that it would be closer to the churches.
Correct.
And right.
And
okay.
Coincidentally, DOT's shop right there.
Oh, okay. So let's start with you, Ray Schwichtenberg, a Nevada City Council member. You've been on the City Council for 6 years, working in earnest with the Iowa DOT to develop this plan for the City of Nevada. Tell us how you felt on November 17th, that Tuesday meeting, when you were faced with such harsh criticism by your constituents.
Thank you, Greta. Good morning. I have... only to think that it was a very emotional meeting. I was surprised personally by the turnout and the comments that were made. It was apparent that there were a lot of folks there that were concerned about the crossings between Nevada and Ames. So for Nevada specifically, it felt like there was plenty of opposition primarily for 6th Street. And having been involved with City Council for 6 years, as well as planning and zoning prior to that, and then Chamber President we've always thought about our downtown business district as an important aspect of our community and an access to have that fully opened. But we were led to believe by DOT that we had few choices. We were given two plans, and we chose the one we felt was the best one.
Okay, so in both of the plans that were presented to you by the DOT, 6th Street was closed in both of them?
Yes, they were.
Okay. And so what are your concerns now as the city moves forward in its relationship with the Iowa DOT and with the council's relationship with the public? You're kind of in the middle there.
Initially, we wanted S-14 remedied, and that's still our purpose. Whether we can come up with a new design or a new plan, I think we'll take some engineering. I don't know that it can all be decided by consensus. Obviously, some smart people have to show us how good, safe roads can be built.
Okay. So, Rick, it seems like a lot of momentum against the Department of Transportation's plan was created by the release of the Phase 2 plan for rural Nevada, west of Nevada, the corridor in between them. So as Story County Supervisor, how did that part of the plan develop? And when did you find out about the proposal for the closing of all those at-grade intersections?
Well, Greta, it developed in concert with what we're calling Phase 1 now, which is the Nevada interchanges, and it just did not, last April, it did not make it onto the five-year calendar for DOT, as they talk about the construction they're going to do over the next 5 years. But we knew it was coming. It had been part of every conversation. You mentioned the three public meetings that DOT held. It had been part of every conversation. But like these things work, and frankly, like they're supposed to work, people sit up and take notice when it starts to become reality, when some ink starts to go on paper and you start talking about it actually happening. And I would just add this. Hey, this is governance is a messy process. It's not supposed to be clean. It's not supposed to be easy. And from my view, while this has been a complex issue that has some really high emotions, this is exactly the way the process is supposed to work. I mean, the citizens are really led by Randy in a lot of ways. Randy wasn't the only one who was worked up. There were lots of people, but Randy was the first one who publicly came to the Board of Supervisors. We had other comments in our ears behind the scene. Randy did his homework, really did a nice job organizing. And maybe organizing is too strong a word. I don't know that group needed a lot of organization, but did a great job bringing a group of citizens together to make sure that their concerns, their questions, and their voice was heard on this issue. And like I say, it is complex. I haven't heard anybody yet who disagrees that we need to do something with Sandhill Trail and we need to do something with S-14. The disagreement lies in what exactly you're doing and how that impacts every other intersection, including, you know, 6th Street, which is Main Street in Nevada, including the areas where Vedder Construction just built a $9 million building and is a great community partner. How you're going to do all of those things for somebody like Randy, who lives just south of Highway 30 but has to move to the north regularly, this is going to directly impact how they do things. And the part of this that we haven't talked about yet is the dramatic impact that not only the co-op, Lincoln Way Energy, and DuPont has, in addition to the plans that the City of Ames, I saw they just secured in excess of 80% for annexation in order to do an entire industrial park basically from Barilla all the way out to DuPont. Think about the impact of traffic that's going to have on that area of Highway 30 and Lincoln Way. We've got some big things happening that we better have a full conversation. There's no doubt that people's lives are going to be impacted. There's no doubt that traffic patterns are going to change in some way in X amount of time. There's no doubt that some major dollars are going to be spent just from the county's perspective, whatever happens, including nothing. The county's going to have to put in several million dollars in order to improve the infrastructure in that area in order to accommodate the realities of the traffic patterns out there. City of Nevada, I know, is already, $1.5 million or so is what you guys had talked about.
That's what we had earmarked for this project.
Putting in. So there's some not just state dollars, not just federal dollars that we're talking about spending. We're talking about spending some very real local dollars in that area, and it is going to happen regardless of what decisions are made, the question is what is going to be getting done out there, and that's why I'm so appreciative of the conversations that we're able to have to get this done. And let me just say this about DOT. DOT is doing exactly what DOT is supposed to do in looking at the way traffic patterns are working. There's no question. For years and years and years, there's been this goal to restrict access to Highway 30 and turn it into more of an interstate type feel. They're just doing that. That said, DOT has to listen to the voices of those most directly impacted, and that's exactly what we're getting to with Randy and the other people living in the area.
Okay, well done. Thank you for making that transition to our next guest, Randy. You're a rural Nevada resident and a farmer.
Correct, yes. Thank you, Greta.
And as I recall, your testimony at the supervisors' meeting concerned, first of all, the difficulty farmers would have with the proposed DOT plan, driving big equipment, big trucks full of grain to those establishments that Rick referred to on Lincoln Way. And second of all, you had some issues with the statistics that Iowa Department of Transportation was presenting regarding safety.
Absolutely. The equipment the farmers generally drive, combines 18-foot wide, you got big machinery that doesn't fold sometimes, and it's not so much worried about what I am doing as a driver of a tractor or a combine, it's what is the other person that's going around me or that I meet on the road, what are they going to do? So everybody's concerned about safety. Nobody wants anybody ever to get hurt. That being said, a curb road like on Airport Road, like where they're wanting to funnel the traffic, is very, very hazardous. I watched a combine come out of Van Wall just the other day. First thing he did, he jumped the curb, put some wheels up over the curb, and that's where he drove. And the combine squiggles down the road. That's just the best way to describe it. If I'm meeting that combine, I've got concerns about meeting that combine as a driver of a car or truck. So that being said, direct safety concerns, I just as soon would travel on a gravel road that's wide, which we do have that availability. One other thing that was not shown in the DOT maps that they had presented in all locations, at Gates Hall, Nevada, as well as back in 2013, as well as this recent Baptist Church meeting in 2015, they never, ever, ever, ever showed the crossings available for the farmer to get from the north part of this area to the south part, being the Union Pacific Railroad has a rail yard, it's the best way to describe it, where a lot of intersections are blocked off and the farmer does not have access from the north part, just north of Highway 30, to south of Highway 30 and vice versa. The only avenues with which the farmer can travel is 580th, which has truck traffic on now and is going to have more truck traffic with the cellulosic plant opening up within the next year. 600th Avenue is the only other avenue between Ames and Nevada with which a farmer can move his equipment from north to south and south to north. That just adds to the confusion. It's a wonderful road to travel. I travel it many times myself.
You're talking about 600th?
600th, yes. It's used by many, many farmers. Many farmers have come up to me and go, what's really going on with this whole process? They're planning on cutting that road off, our access from north to south.
And that one feeds directly to the ethanol plant.
Yeah, that happens to be the same road that goes to the ethanol plant, the corn ethanol plant, the cellulosic plant. There will be trucks coming down that road as well. Mm-hmm. There will be going to the Key Co-op. And you also have fertilizer leaving Key Co-op that needs accessibility to the south part of the county. Literally, they're shutting off an artery, you can call it that, an artery to the south part of the county that is needed. So that's the main concern. That's where I had a dog in this fight. When the DOT brought 600th Avenue into the Nevada plan, I had a problem with that.
Okay.
And I would just add to what Randy just said, 600th between Highway 30 and Lincoln Highway is currently designated a farm-to-market road, which is important for federal funding and how it's expected to be used, much like Randy talks about, as a farm-to-market utilization for our gentlemen that are farming.
Okay. So you looked into the statistics Iowa DOT was presenting and found some things that you wanted to expose.
Yes, yes. Anytime I worked off the farm as well as farm for 21 years, anytime that somebody lumps figures together, I've got a problem because they're trying to cover up something. what, be it intentionally or non-intentionally, that's what's happening. So I was able to take the 258 accidents within the corridor, within the DOT's specifications, and single them out to where the accident rates are not truly, at these intersections, are truly not what the DOT is really saying. In the DOT's own specifications of these accidents, they said 30% of them are animal-related. Okay, this highway is not going to, this improvement is not going to take care of that. 9.8% was maybe related to speeding. Another 7-point-some percent was related to falling too close. None of those will be taken by this Highway 30 improvement. So you're literally addressing almost 50% of the accidents you're really not addressing with this Highway 30 improvement. That being said, the accident rates at the 590th and 600th in the last 5 years in each of those locations have been less than one accident per year. Even the worst intersection in Story County, which is 580th Avenue, and there have been a lot of accidents there in past history, it only had one accident last year. What'd they do to change that? They changed the turn lanes off of Highway 30, massively improved them, to where there's fantastic visibility for the person turning off of Highway 30 and visibility for the person pulling onto Highway 30, which I think is wonderful.
Okay. In fact, I did speak with Scott Dockstader, the engineer from the Iowa Department of Transportation, and my background research was simply listening to you, Randy, at the supervisors' meeting summarize these points. And so I asked Scott about these issues and whether maybe keeping certain aspects of the existing situation would be a possibility in the revision.
In terms of the alternatives, many of the people at the public input session were hoping they could see more of these deceleration lanes, such as the one that has been installed at 580th and that has reduced the number of traffic accidents there. Is that something that you're going to consider in your revision of the project as it moves forward?
The fundamental issue with the Highway 30 corridor is you have a four-lane road with at-grade crossings, and with the traffic volumes that we have, our concerns are the cross-traffic T-bone type intersection hits. So offset right turn lanes don't correct those issues or those concerns that we have along the corridor. So at this point, we're not planning offset right turn lanes at other locations along the corridor, no.
Some folks also mentioned that many of the accidents are caused by animals, and that certain animal barriers could be set up and eliminate that problem. Is that something that you will consider in the revision?
No, we're not. I'm not aware of an animal barrier project corridor type concept we could do to keep deer off of Highway 30.
One more thing that was suggested was to decrease the speed limit on that road. Post signs, lower the speed limit so that simply there's less likelihood of accidents. Is that possible in the corridor project plan?
Yeah, just simply lowering the speed limit doesn't reduce accidents. That's not the way it works, and it doesn't happen that way. You can't just go out there and lower it to 45 miles per hour and have less accidents. All your speed studies, safety studies will show that if you artificially lower the speed limit, you're going to have a differential speed issue where some people are traveling faster than the speed limit, others are traveling the speed limit, and then you have this speed differential which will make it less safe. So we don't want to do anything that makes the roadway less safe.
Okay, so that was Scott Dockstader when I spoke with him on Friday about these various issues that Randy had raised. Comments, anyone, about what you heard?
I would just say this, it's always easy to vilify and believe that somebody has ill intentions. Scott Dockstader is a great guy. I mean, he's a great guy who does his job really, really well, and that's exactly what he's trying to do here is his job. We just happen to be on opposite sides of what needs to happen out there. It makes perfect sense to me that this would be a highly emotional issue for many involved because it directly impacts their day-to-day lives. We had one couple that spoke that don't farm, but they live in the area, and it would dramatically change the way that they would, anytime they went somewhere, the way they would have to go. It makes sense. I would believe that DOT very rarely has a project that makes everybody happy. I mean, it doesn't work that way. And so Scott is put in the very – Scott and people that like Scott are put in the very tough position of trying to make decisions that they view is in the greater good while it has a dramatic negative impact on some people. In this case, the Board of Supervisors felt strongly that closing all of these intersections was not the way to go. And I was a little on a little bit of an opposite side as we started the conversation and came around to the thinking of my counterparts. And that's, again, that's the way the process is supposed to work.
Last word, Ray Schwichtenberg from the Nevada City Council. The council voted to form a new task force to communicate with the Iowa DOT. Can you tell me what you know about how this task force will be selected?
Tonight is our city council meeting. I hope to address that more clearly, but our intent is to take all the input we can. We're thankful for the community in their effort to point out different opinions and show us that there may be an alternative, and certainly they have our support as far as what to do in the future.
Okay. Well, thank you all for being here and talking about this issue. KHOI's mission is to build community through communication, and just let us know how we can help.
Greta, thanks. Great job.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you much.
Okay, when we return, more politics at the national and state level.
Sometimes you bend, sometimes you stand, sometimes you turn your back to the wind. There's a world outside the darkened door where blues won't haunt you anymore. With a brave heart, free lover's soul, come ride with me to the distant shore. We won't hesitate, break down the guarded gate. There's not much time left today.
This is KHOI Community Radio, Story City Ames. I'm Gail Seiler, and I'm joined via phone by Carolyn Isaacs. Are you there, Carolyn?
I'm here. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for being with us. Carolyn Isaacs is the Arizona Program Director of the American Friends Service Committee. She will be in Iowa this week, and she'll be speaking here in Ames on Wednesday at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, and the title of her talk will be Iowans Have a Role in Ending These For-Profit Schemes. I believe that's the exact title. And she's with us now. Thank you. Is that the exact title of your talk?
I think the for-profit schemes that you're referring to are immigrant detention and mass incarceration.
Okay.
So that might have gotten cut off.
Yeah, I think maybe I copied something wrong, but thanks. So sure. Your talk is on the proliferation of private, not-for-profit prisons and detention centers. Could you give us – we don't want to – you know, we don't expect you to give you your whole talk because we want people to go to your talk, but how big is this problem? Can you give us an idea of the extent of it?
Sure. Well, it's interesting. You know, each state makes its own criminal justice policy. And then you have another set of policies on the federal level. And so state by state, it really varies. In Arizona, we have about 15% of our state prisoners in private prisons. I think the largest percentage is in New Mexico, where they have almost half. And some states don't have privately operated prisons at all. On the federal level, however, and in particular in immigrant detention, mm-hmm. about half of our nation's immigrant detainees are held in privately operated facilities by for-profit corporations.
Okay, so yeah, I think we hear more about the for-profit prisons that actually hold prisoners who've been convicted of crimes, and we hear less about these for-profit detention facilities. So what are they?
So this is essentially a government contract. So your state government, the Federal Bureau of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, will bid out a contract for the management of one of their detention or prison facilities. And it's a competitive process. So these corporations are competing with one another. And, of course, we all know the way to get a contract is to be the lowest bidder. That presents a real problem when you're doing something that is inherently expensive because you have literal life and death power over the people in your custody. You have to provide them with food and medical care and theoretically rehabilitation, right, which is supposed to be the purpose of these systems. But then these corporations also have to do that job, do it supposedly cheaper than the state, and then skim a profit off the top of that for their CEO and for their shareholders.
And so who is housed in these detention centers, and how long are typically people kept there?
In the immigrant detention center?
Yes, yes, specifically.
It really varies. You have, here in Arizona, for example, we have a program called Operation Streamline, where people are detained for anywhere from 60, 180 days or so. That's by the U.S. Marshals Service. They're essentially waiting to be deported.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're being held for shorter periods of time. Then you have some people who are seeking asylum in the United States, and that is a very long process where, you know, there's a very long waiting list, and folks, their stories need to be corroborated, the evidence needs to be gathered, and that can take years.
The title of your talk uses the phrase, the role of Iowans. So many of us here in Iowa may think, oh, we're far from the Mexican border. A lot of these concerns, you know, aren't something I need to pay attention to. But you're going to make the case that it is, and Iowans are playing a role. Could you say a bit about that?
Certainly. I mean, I think we all have a role. We know, I think, over the years that the border, while there are particular issues related to border communities, the issue of criminalization of immigration has certainly migrated along with the individuals who have come to the States with documentation or without. And so those policies, the enforcement, the criminalization of that activity of crossing the border or crossing the border again comes with them. And I think all communities then, you know, as we have, you know, law enforcement grappling with these decisions, you have these intergovernmental agreements between your local law enforcement and the federal government to check people's IDs and things like that. Those issues are traveling along with the folks that are impacted by them.
And will you? You'll also be talking about the lobbying powers and the political influence that these.
You betcha. So this is the
have.
Other thing, of course,
yeah.
That you know, the candidates are coming to you all,
right,
in Iowa to glad hand you and eat your local food and drink your coffee, and you have a chance to say to them, hey, you know, I'm concerned about these issues. Is this on your radar? Do you know that there is a quota in the federal budget that requires us to pay a corporation to detain a certain number of immigrants in these facilities? And there are corporations making millions of dollars off that policy, and asking them about their connections to these corporations, because they certainly do spend a lot of money lobbying and making direct campaign contributions to people who are running for office. We've certainly seen a lot of that with Marco Rubio. We know that Governor Christie is very closely tied to a private company that runs halfway houses in New Jersey that's looking for more contracts. So, you know, asking those folks when they're there to press the flesh is a great way to raise the profile of these issues.
So the American Friends Service Committee has been actively involved in Iowa trying to promote those kinds of questions being asked of the candidates while they're here. How else does do you in your role with the American Friends Service Committee and the American Friends Service Committee kind of how else do you go at these issues? How do you advocate for change in these areas?
Sure. Well, I'm here in Arizona, the heart of darkness, which Stephen Colbert dubbed the meth lab of democracy at one point. And so we certainly are a place where many of these private corporations are expanding. They're very influential. And so one of the tactics that we've used very successfully is just sunlight. The fact that these companies are for-profit entities means that they are not as transparent or accountable to the public as government agencies, even though they're doing the job of the government and paid with our tax dollars. So we do a lot of original research, and it's constantly astounding to me the fact that our government, federal and state, are spending millions of dollars on these contracts, and in most cases, nobody's minding the store. They're not studying whether or not these companies are actually saving us money the way they promise. They're not studying whether they're providing safe facilities or rehabilitating individuals. Just the fact of looking into that and doing that research on our part has been very effective because nobody else is bothered.
And you've been doing this work, from what I gathered online when I read a little bit about you, for about 15 years. Yeah. Would you say that we're kind of at the worst position or time for this now, or what has your work been in this area?
Honestly, I would say this is the most exciting time. We are poised, I think, for major changes in our criminal justice and possibly immigration policies in this country. We woke up from the Get Tough on Crime 90s with this massive budget hangover in most states going, whoa, we're sure spending a lot to incarcerate people. And do all of those people really need to be in those facilities where we're spending, $30,000 a year on one person? So that conversation, Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, has, church groups are doing, book reading projects on that. There is now a conversation about these policies that would have been absolutely the third rail of politics, even 5 years ago in many states. And so that gives me tremendous hope that, really in many cases, it's just the voters, it's the people out ahead of the politicians saying, this is making no sense. Why are we doing this?
Well, that's great to hear that you're optimistic, and your talks here will help educate Iowans further, and then maybe we can bring about some change. Do you want to quickly tell us about any other events? You're going to be in Ames on Wednesday night at 7 p.m. at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship on Highland Avenue, and we'll put a link to information about that on our website. You'll be in Des Moines as well?
I'm going to be all over the place, okay. And to tell you the truth, I am in the car on the way to the airport, so I don't have it in front of me. But I'm sure if you go to probably the Governing Under the Influence website, that will have all of our events.
Okay.
I know I'll be at Drake University. Wherever they send me,
okay.
I will go.
All right. Well, we're going to put a link to all of that so people can get information and attend if these are topics that they want to educate themselves more about. Thank you so much for talking with us en route to the airport, and have safe travels getting here. And we look forward to seeing you later this week.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And a privatize that was Carolyn Isaacs of the American Friends Service Committee from Arizona. And she was talking about privatization of the prison system and immigration detention. Privatization is also the topic of our next story. Ever since September, when Governor Branstad announced that he would be turning over the administration of Iowa's Medicaid system to four private companies on January 1st of 2016, now less than a month away, opposition to the plan has been growing. We had Ames Representative Lisa Heddens on the show a few weeks back to describe how this new system of, quote, managed care and the very hasty transition to it came about without legislative input and how it might affect Iowans. Today, dozens of Iowans who will be affected by this change are doing something about it. They plan to exercise their First Amendment rights to assemble and petition their government. I spoke with one of the organizers yesterday. I'm talking with Rhonda Schaus of Marion, Iowa, north of Cedar Rapids. Rhonda is getting ready to go on a bus trip to Des Moines, Iowa this Monday morning. Rhonda, can you tell us what's going on down there?
Yes. The legislature is holding what is called a legislative oversight committee meeting, and it's a five-hour meeting. They're going to be discussing the Governor Branstad's proposal for moving from Medicaid to managed care, and our group feels that this particular proposal is moving on too fast of a time frame, so we felt it was important that we get to Des Moines to make our voices heard.
Okay, and will there be opportunities at this meeting for you to make your voices heard, or will this simply be a protest outside?
This will be inside. We actually, we're very organized. I've called in advance, and they have set up seats for our group. We'll be set in the rotunda on the first floor, and there is a public comment section of the meeting in the afternoon for 90 minutes. With 90 minutes, you're allowed a maximum of 5 minutes per person, and so at the most, there will be probably 18 or 19 people speaking.
Okay, and the committee that you're addressing, again, is the Oversight Committee? Is it the House or the Senate or both?
It's a combination. There are 10 legislators, 5 senators, and 5 House of Representatives. I believe it breaks down as with the House being currently run by the Republicans. I believe there are more Republican House members on this, and then on the Senate side, there's more Democratic members, I believe.
Okay. So it's not just you from Cedar Rapids and your busload of people, but I understand there's buses and vans coming from Iowa City and Sioux City as well.
Correct. I organize from all across the state. And so we have a bus leaving Cedar Rapids as well as a charter bus from Iowa City. We have people driving from Dubuque, Manchester, Clinton, Davenport, DeWitt, Muscatine, all of those to get to our two buses. And then from the western side of the state, we have a couple vans coming from Sioux City. And I know in Iowa City, we also have a van coming that's wheelchair equipped, as well as one wheelchair fully equipped van out of Cedar Rapids. So we've got several vehicles, but we're all within one group.
About how many people do you estimate among your group?
About 75 to 80.
Okay. And Rhonda, can I ask, how did you organize these people? Through Facebook, social media?
Social media played a large role in it. I've been studying this for the last 4 months. I've been keeping on top of it. And I've been on all the CMS listening posts, the teleconference calls that CMS scheduled.
What is CMS?
It's the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. It's the federal government. They give a portion of the money that covers Medicaid, and the state matches the rest. And so the federal government, CMS, is required to give approval to Governor Branstad in order to go forward with this. And as of today, they have not. And so they held listening posts, which were teleconferences, for various target audiences. And the first one was for Medicaid members, family members, advocates. And over 500 people were on that call. We maxed out their call capacity. There was no organization as far as who got to talk first or anything. People were literally speaking over each other. It was chaos. And on that call, I realized we need to have a unified voice in Des Moines for this particular meeting. So I priced a charter bus, realized quickly we could not afford it ourselves as Medicaid members, and got to doing some research on the Internet. I approached a donor and said, hey, I have this idea. We can't afford it. Can you help us? And this anonymous donor came forward and said, yes, we feel it's important for you to have a voice, and we will pay for your travel, and we will also, since it will be such a long day, we will also provide you with lunch.
Wow. And so you are yourself a Medicaid recipient?
I am, yes. And I also have a daughter who is as well.
Okay. And so that's probably the basis of your involvement and concerns about this issue.
That's a large part of it. I have been doing mental health advocacy in the state for over 10 years. So I've been an advocate before. This particular issue happens to be one that crosses disability lines, and so it's united a lot of people from a lot of disability communities that have never traditionally worked together. But yes, we did go to social media. We have on the Facebook, we have a group called MCO Space Watchdog, and I took my idea to that group, and it mushroomed from there. As of this morning, there were over 450 members.
There's a lot that's interesting. We don't have a lot of time. The idea that people from all different disabilities have been getting together and having conversations. Can you briefly talk about what that's been like?
It's been very empowering. Individuals in the group, there are several like me who have advocated for a long time. We're finding a lot of people who have never advocated for themselves or a family member, have never felt they needed to before. And this particular issue is touching so many lives, and the implications are so scary, especially with the very little concrete information we've been given, that people are having to step outside their comfort zones. And so it's been very empowering. I think people who have not done this, advocated before, are taking strength from those of us who have and realizing we really do have a voice. And we may not change the outcome. Managed care may come to Iowa. But if nothing else, we would like to have our voice heard, and we would love to have it delayed from the January 1st implementation date.
Okay, and the name of your group again is?
We don't have one. We are grassroots as grassroots can get.
Okay. Well, we're going to have a local person talk a little bit more about the particular detriments of this proposal, and we hope to catch you on the bus as you cross the state on your way to Des Moines. Well, thank you so much, Rhonda.
You are welcome. Thank you.
And thank you for the work you do on behalf of people with disabilities in Iowa.
Thank you so much, Greta.
And that was Rhonda Schaus of Marion, Iowa, who is organizing busloads of Iowans from Cedar Rapids, Iowa City, and Sioux City. She sent me her day's itinerary, a very busy day, and we've got her on the line. She's going to talk to us from the bus. But here in the studio, we have someone who is driving his own carload of people from Ames to join Rhonda and others, Tom Andre. Welcome, Tom.
Good morning.
And Tom, can you tell us briefly what your main objections to the governor's privatization plan?
Well, I think I've been reading in the articles in the Register and other places that indicate there seems to be a lot of problems with this issue. First of all, there were reports of that state officials were inappropriately talking to the private companies who were bidding for the contracts. An early poll by the Des Moines Register found that only a very small proportion of Iowans, about 22%, supported the change. The governor's office hasn't been able to substantiate why the proposed savings that they're saying will occur. A review of studies by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation indicates that there's no evidence of any savings at the national level, and that if there are savings in individual states, it's very mixed and very varied and may depend upon conditions that may or may not apply to Iowa. And like many people, we realize that private businesses need to make money, and that means that they will have higher administrative costs than state-run programs, typically. And a good example is Medicare, which has lower administrative costs than private health insurance.
Okay. So you don't necessarily have a direct connection to the issue. You're just a concerned citizen who wants government done right.
That's how I started, yeah. I spent most of my life being a research psychologist, but I've always been concerned about social issues. And now that I'm retired, I've got time to do that.
Okay. Well, thank you, Tom, for coming in and sharing your perspectives. Can we talk to somebody on the bus?
Hi, my name is Stacy.
Oh, Stacy. Hi, Stacy.
Hi.
You're traveling from Cedar Rapids to Des Moines.
Correct, yes.
Where are you right now?
We just went past Williamsburg.
Okay, Williamsburg. So why are you going to Des Moines today?
I'm the caregiver to an adult man with Down syndrome in Cedar Rapids, and he's on Medicaid. And he has multiple different providers for various reasons, and they're kind of, you know, so far scattered among the four MCOs. None of them are all in all four.
Oh, okay, the managed care operations.
Correct.
Okay, so this is going to complicate the situation, having all of these four different providers.
Extremely, because he can only be in one, so he's going to have to pick which one has the most providers, but not all of them are in all four.
Okay, so he'll have to switch switch providers if he wants to continue that type of service so that one organization can care for him throughout.
Well, he hasn't even gotten his packet yet, so he doesn't even know what MCO he's in. So when he gets his packet, I'm going to have to look through it to see which one he's in and what's covered, and then try to pick which doctors are the most important and which one has the most providers in it, and then switch them to that one.
Okay, and all this has to happen before January 1st if things go ahead as planned.
Actually, the deadline is December 17th, so in 10 days, and we haven't even received the packet yet.
Oh, that's tricky.
It's extremely tricky.
And do you plan to be on the stand today and speak your mind to the Legislative Oversight Committee?
Yes, I do.
Okay, well, remind me of your name, Stacy?
Stacy, yes.
Okay, well, I applaud your effort to get involved and represent yourself and the person you care for.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
So that was Stacy on the bus from Cedar Rapids to Des Moines, where she will be addressing the Legislative Oversight Committee on the Medicaid privatization. This has been Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. We spoke with three gentlemen discussing the Iowa DOT proposal for Highway 30 corridor between Ames and Nevada. Nevada City Councilman Ray Schwichtenberg, Story County Supervisor Rick Sanders, and rural Nevada resident Randy Collings. We also heard from District 1 engineer from the Iowa DOT, Scott Dockstetter, on this topic. Next, we spoke with Carolyn Isaacs from Arizona, who will speak at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Ames this Wednesday, on the topic of who benefits from immigrant detention and mass incarceration. Finally, we spoke with Rhonda Schaus of Marion, Iowa, who has organized a group heading to Des Moines as we speak to protest the governor's proposed privatization of Medicaid. And Tom Andre, a local Ames resident who will be joining that gathering, stopped in. And we heard from Stacy on the bus.
Details and links to our guests will be available on our website, khoifm.org, later today, along with the downloadable version of the show. Thanks to our webmaster, Ron Carson, for making that possible. We've been your hosts, Gail Seiler and Greta Anderson. Our engineer has been Rick Morrison and Nadia Abdelazim. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards. We also heard music recorded by Tom Cochran, and that's what you're hearing now from 1992.
Tune in to KHOI Community Radio 89.1 FM every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for fresh local talk shows featuring people from your virtual backyard. Each show airs three times, 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m., so plan to catch it at one of those times. We appreciate your listenership and your generous donations. Keep those pledges coming. We need you to help us keep this unique programming on the air. Thanks again for tuning in to 89.1 FM, and we'll see you again on the radio